I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Police have identified the three attackers who they say killed seven people and wounded dozens more on London Bridge and nearby Borough Market on Saturday night. It was a gruesome scene of carnage with the terrorists using a van as a weapon and stabbing people who were enjoying a popular spot in downtown London. Prime Minister Theresa May spoke on Sunday.
Our country has made significant progress in disrupting plots and protecting the public. But it is time to say enough is enough. Everybody needs to go about their lives as they normally would. Our society should continue to function in accordance with our values. But when it comes to taking on extremism and terrorism, things need to change.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who is Muslim, said this in response to the attacks, referencing the three attackers who were killed by the police on Saturday night.
And I'm angry and furious that these three men are seeking to justify their actions by using the faith that I belong to justify their actions. The ideology they follow is perverse, it is poisonous, and it has no place in Islam. And I condemn this terrorist act, but also the poisonous ideology these men and others follow.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. We asked Frank Langfitt, NPR's London correspondent, to discuss the latest news from London, also the reaction to President Trump's tweets about the London mayor and how all of this could affect Thursday's general election. And he joins us from the NPR studios in London. And Frank Langfitt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
What do we know about these three men who have been identified?
Well, the first one that they identified, and I was actually outside of his apartment yesterday, his name is Karam Butt. He was 27, a British citizen born in Pakistan. Another guy, Rashid Redwan, 30, claimed to be Moroccan or Libyan. And the last one that they just told us today is a guy named Youssef Zagba. He's a Moroccan-Italian man, 22 years old. The problem for Theresa May, the problem for security services here is that two of these men were known to MI5, the domestic security operation here in Britain. This guy, Karam Butt, when I was talking to people in the neighborhood, people complained about him to police, that he'd been proselytizing the son of a neighbor. And also, he actually showed up very briefly in a radicalization documentary on Channel 4 here in Britain.
Wow.
So he was known. This guy, Zagba, he apparently was stopped by the Italian police, about a year or two ago, and they had told the British about him as well. So a lot of questions to be answered right now here by British security.
Has British security, have they responded to these I won't say allegations because we're not quite at this point yet, but to these accusations, I guess?
Yeah, well, they're not even accusations. They were aware of these guys, and what they are saying is they have at least 3,000 people they're watching it at any specific time, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 23,000 who are people they're concerned about. And what Theresa May is saying is it's time to have a review of how MI5 has handled this attack and handled other attacks. The fact that this has happened a lot, Marty. I mean, when I was just up in Manchester, a couple weeks ago.
Exactly.
And it was the same story. I was at the mosque, and the man who was the bomber who blew up, killed 22 people outside of the Ariana Grande concert, the people at the mosque had complained about him. So there was a drumbeat in the communities, actually, of people saying, well, we are informing the police, but this is still happening. So this comes 2 days before the election. It's a really big question. It's dominating the discussion here.
Well, how do you think this will play out? The election, it's a general election. It's on Thursday.
Well, it's interesting. Ordinarily, you would think that this would be a complete disaster for Theresa May. She was Home Secretary for many years, and that's basically in charge of Homeland Security. But the politics here are very tricky. The Conservatives, she's the Tory party, the Conservatives generally do well on security issues. So people generally tend to like them when they're feeling uncertain. And Jeremy Corbyn, the head of the Labour Party, who's running against May and has been closing the gap very surprisingly. This was a month ago, supposed to be a landslide. He seems soft on terrorism. So he's kind of exactly the person that Theresa May would want to be running against in this kind of environment. That said, Theresa May, this is the last thing she'd like to be discussing 2 days before 2 days before the election.
Let me play something that Jeremy Corbyn said. This was at a press conference yesterday.
You cannot protect the public on the cheap. The police and security services must get the resources they need, not 20,000 police cuts. Theresa May was warned by the Police Federation, but she accused them of crying wolf.
Is there some truth to that, Frank?
The cuts did occur. What happened, if you go back to the global financial crisis, this was David Cameron's government. He's Tory prime minister. They did make cuts to the police here. And that's now coming back to haunt Theresa May. And this very much puts the ball in her court. And what Corbyn's trying to do here is he's been really focusing his campaign, kind of as Bernie Sanders did in the United States last year, on social issues, on helping young people, on restoring a lot of austerity cuts that went to communities following the global financial crisis. And this plays into his narrative. It's fascinating because he's a socialist. He's seen as a very soft lefty. But here he is talking about spending more money on police. So he's trying to use this very much to his advantage to say, well, Theresa May, she talks a tough game, but she doesn't put the money into it. And that's that's his line of attack right now.
Now, she called for this election, correct?
Yes, she did. I wonder if she regrets that.
I'm wondering as well. And why did she call for this election?
She thought this was totally in the bag. Marty, if you go back to April when she called this, she was looking at a 20-point victory. People back then, I was doing stories for NPR on this, they were talking about her and using, you know, references to Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher, multiple-term prime ministers who had very big majorities. And so she thought this was going to be just a cakewalk. Well, it's now, last time I saw a few days ago, the polls somewhere in the 8 to 9 point range. We don't know what's going to happen on election day, but it's far closer than anybody thought it would be. And I think probably in the Tory party, everyone's kind of scratching their heads.
Did she call it because of Brexit that she wanted more support or something
exactly.
from the public?
It was highly strategic in the sense that she's going into what could be considered like the toughest thing that any prime minister has had to do in this country in decades, which is disentangle from the European Union. It's a very difficult thing to do. You have to untangle all of these relationships, and it's going to take a long time. And there is divisions in the country. It was only a 52-48% vote to leave the EU. And there's also divisions in the party. And what she wanted to do was get a big majority in parliament so she could drive through and sort of feel like she had a lot of political strength when she went and negotiated this exit with Brussels. Well, she doesn't look like, it seems unlikely that she's going to get the big, big majorities that she thought she was going to get when she called this election back in April.
So has terrorism replaced Brexit as a driving issue?
I don't. Yes and no. I think that terrorism is what people are talking about. But a lot of people have known Theresa May for a long time. They've known Jeremy Corbyn forever. And a lot of them have made up their minds by now. Whether, you know, how much more he can close the gap, also given that he has liabilities himself on the terrorism issue. You got to remember, a long time ago, he once referred to members of Hamas and Hezbollah as friends. The Tories bring that up and remind people of his leanings. So I think a lot of people have made up their minds, and it's not likely necessarily to shift the vote a lot just in the final 48 hours.
When Theresa May says enough is enough, what do you think she's referring to?
I think that's a great, great question, Marty. And I wonder if the prime minister knows herself. Because if enough is enough, where do you go from here? They already have a lot of surveillance in the United Kingdom, especially here in London. Their laws are nowhere near as strict in terms of privacy laws as we would have in the United States. I think what she's talking about is probably getting a lot tougher. What she says is a lot tougher on the internet in terms of trying to be able to prevent people from recruiting, you know, ISIS recruiting on the internet, and also probably putting a lot more pressure on the ground on radical Islamist groups who don't at the moment violate the law. Exactly how she would do that, she hasn't spelled out for us. And of course, I don't think she wants to because she's just trying to get through election day at this point.
This is the third terrorist attack in England in the last couple of months since March. Mm-hmm. Has there been a kind of cumulative effect on the British people?
I think there has been. I covered all three of these, and the first one came towards the end of March. It was very similar to the attack that we saw on London Bridge on Saturday night. A man took a small SUV, drove down Westminster Bridge on the way to Big Ben, ended up killing ultimately, I believe, five people on the bridge. And That night, I got on the train to go home, and it was a typical kind of London British keep calm response. People were horrified by it, but people had already adjusted really within a matter of hours. They had adjusted to this. The Manchester bombing was really awful. It wasn't here in London, but I think it really affected people because it was young people. It was young families. There had never been an attack quite like that in the United Kingdom. And then this last one, there's this drumbeat effect. And I think people are much more affected now. And you get some people are still giving you sort of the old British stiff upper lip, but there are other people who
would,
well, and there is some of that, and I think it's genuine. And you know, people, you talk in London, they'll say, we went through the Blitz, we went through the IRA bombings in the 70s and the 80s, we are very tough stock, and I think that's true. I also talk to people who are genuinely really frightened and don't want to come into central London.
And are they frightened of their neighbors, thinking that their neighbors might be a terrorist?
I don't know. I don't have a real good feel for that. I've been going into the communities where these people live, the terrorists have lived, the killers. And there is a lot of tension. And there is a sort of sense of looking around and everybody feeling just on edge because of the focus on the communities. Certainly, I went to the mosque that Salman Abedi's family went to. He's the bomber in Manchester. And I spent hours out in and outside of the mosque. And the mosque felt really, they felt under tremendous pressure, tremendous scrutiny, and very uncomfortable. And I was actually talking to an imam outside of the mosque. I actually was one of the trustees of the mosque. And a man walked by and called him scum and just, you know, was really verbally abusive. So, yeah, you can definitely feel, I think, in those communities where the terrorists were living, there is a lot of tension.
About a minute before our first break here, Frank, and I'm thinking of the Ariana Grande Memorial Concert, the picture of the crowds of people that came to that concert, obviously wanting to send a very strong message.
A very strong message. And I think that some people would probably say these attacks, some people have phrased this, I've heard this, the idea that this is an attack on joy, Western joy. Think about it. Ariana Grande concert. She's a good performer, very popular, young people coming out there. Certainly the attack Saturday night, London Bridge, Borough Market, a wonderful part of London, a place where people come, bars, restaurants, you know, really lively area. And I think people perceive it that way. And I think the Ariana Grande concert was a way to really push back and say, this is who we are. We love this kind of music. We love to get out and do this. And so people came out. And you probably saw the video.
Yep.
It was a very successful concert. A lot of really great performances. The audience was really into it, and there were no incidents.
And that's Frank Langfitt. He's NPR's London correspondent, joining us from the NPR studios in London. We've been talking about the terror attacks. And I do want to talk about London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, and a bit of the back and forth between Sadiq Khan and the president of the United States. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Frank Langfitt is our guest, NPR's London correspondent. We've been talking about the latest news about the London terror attacks. We've also been talking about how this could affect Thursday's general election. I do want to talk about the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and there has been a lot of back and forth and response, I should say, to President Trump's tweets, and I do want to get to that. But first, let me ask you, Frank Langfitt, tell us about Sadiq Khan. How long has he been mayor of London?
I think he's been mayor about a year or two. And he's very popular. He's a youngish guy in his 40s. He's the son of a Pakistani bus driver, very well educated, very polished, cosmopolitan. And I think his message, the big banners you see now is London is open. The whole idea is he wants this to be, it is a very cosmopolitan city. He wants it to be open to the world, to people from the greatest talent that he can find from around the world, and a very dynamic, popular mayor.
Well, let me play something he said on Sunday, and this is London Mayor Sadiq Khan.
Londoners will see an increased police presence today and over the course of the next few days. No reason to be alarmed. One of the things the police and all of us need to do is make sure we're as safe as we possibly can be. I'm reassured that we are one of the safest global cities in the world, if not the safest global city in the world. But we always evolve and review ways to make sure that we remain as safe as we possibly can.
President Trump tweeted, and this was on Sunday, I believe, at least seven dead, 48 wounded in terror attack, and London mayor says there is no reason to be alarmed. Frank, what's been the response in England to, I mean, it must be said that President Trump distorted what the mayor of London said.
Yeah, it's completely out of context and completely obviously misleading to anybody who listened to the mayor. People here are angry about it. They don't. You got to remember, people in London don't like Donald Trump. They don't want.
They don't
him
like
to,
him.
No, they don't like him at all. He is to them, I think, the embodiment of the ugly American. To be perfectly blunt, bombastic, certainly not modest, and that doesn't go over very well here. It's also not the first time that a Trump family member has distorted something that Mayor Khan has said. Donald Trump Jr. did the same thing, took something out of context after the Westminster Bridge attack back in March. And then today, I think it's hard to keep track, but I believe it was Monday that the president then, when Sadiq Khan said he'd been taken out of context, he called this pathetic, that this was some pathetic excuse by the mayor. And to put this in context, I guess, again, for our listeners, you have the president of the United States attacking the mayor of the capital of our closest ally after it's been hit twice with terrorist attacks in a matter of under 2.5 months. Yeah. It's extraordinary. And so people hate this here. They don't understand why anybody would do this, let alone your friend.
Well, let me play one more thing, and this is the London mayor speaking on Monday. He was on BBC Four.
You know, I don't think we should be rolling out the red carpet to the president of the USA in the circumstances where his policies go against everything we stand for. I think one of the things, when you have a special relationship, it's not different, no different to when you've got a close mate. You stand with them in times of adversity, but you call them out when they're wrong. And there are many things about which Donald Trump is wrong.
Do you think the U.S. still has a special relationship with England, frankly?
I think it does. Certainly Theresa May has come out and said that she thinks Sadiq Khan has done a very good job. And she was actually, I mean, she's taken heat for this. You know, she has a relatively close relationship with the president. Yeah. And that's politically, domestically difficult because he's not so popular here. But I'm sure it'll survive. And of course, Sadiq Khan is just the mayor of London. The queen is the one who gives the invitation. There's no sign whatsoever that this invitation would be rescinded for President Trump to come. But I can tell you that there are thoughts here, certainly in London, that it would be good for him not to actually come to London.
Oh, and
because if he came to London, imagine what the crowds and the protests would be like. During the march, the march after the inauguration, you had the Women's March in Washington. Well, in Trafalgar Square, it was huge numbers of people protesting the president. In fact, the walk from the U.S. Embassy to Trafalgar Square became so big that people I knew had to just leave because they couldn't even move. If he actually were to come to London, I think the city would be shut down.
Do we know when this is planned
No, we don't. We don't, because also we don't have an ambassador, Mr. Trump's ambassador is not here yet. He has not been approved yet. So, and we don't know when that would happen. And certainly it would make no sense for the president to come here before he actually had his ambassador in place. So this would be sometime in the future. But there have been talk about having him actually go out to Balmoral and kind of trying to avoid London altogether.
Mm. I'm looking at something that the acting ambassador said in response to the attacks. This is a guy named Lewis Lukens. He says, "It's with a heavy heart I offer my condolences and support to the people of the United Kingdom. America grieves with you, the response from emergency services, law enforcement officials in London, as well as ordinary Londoners has been extraordinary," which sounds a lot like what a president would say under
Precisely.
These circumstances.
Well, yeah, that's a normal tweet. Here you have a very close relationship with the United Kingdom. London has been hurting terribly. The UK has been hurting. That is something any ordinary diplomat would, of course, put out there. Very different than what the president had to say.
I'm curious about London Bridge and this this market nearby. Is it basically back in business? Is it considered a crime scene now?
I think it may have opened back up. Part of London Bridge, I believe most of London Bridge has opened back up. I'm not sure yet that Borough Market has opened back up. I'm looking forward to going there. I'll just tell you on a personal note, it's my daughter Katie's, she's 15, it's her favorite place in London.
Really?
It's under a train trestle. It is all of these stalls. You can get food from all over the world, a great melting pot right on the south bank of the Thames. And I'm looking forward, frankly, to when it reopens, because I think people will flood in there, because I think it's symbolic and emblematic of the city in terms of its diversity and its openness to the world.
Final question to you, Frank. Do we know the status of those who were injured? I read that a number of them were seriously injured, and of course these are knife wounds.
Yeah, they are. I think that there are still a number of people in critical condition. I can't tell you how many. Of course, as we know, 7 did die.
Yeah.
I don't know if any are, you know, right at that level that they might pass away as well. But we haven't heard any. We certainly have not heard that anyone else has died.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times and getting us up to speed on what's been happening. Thanks so much, Frank Langfitt.
Happy to do it, Marty.
And he's NPR's London correspondent, again, joining us from the NPR studios in London. Well, from England to the United States, I'm Marty Moscawen, and you're listening to Radio Times.
We're proposing reduced wait times, increased route efficiency, and far fewer delays. Our plan will get you where you need to go more quickly, more reliably, more affordably, and yes, for the first time in a long time, on time. We will launch this air travel revolution by modernizing the outdated system of air traffic control. It's about time.
And that was President Trump speaking on Monday about his plan to privatize the country's air traffic control system. This legislation is based on some of the ideas of Bill Shuster, Republican from Pennsylvania, also head of the House Transportation Committee, for a private nonprofit to operate and manage the system. The president is going to roll out other plans this week to upgrade the nation's aging infrastructure. Candidate Trump called for a $1 trillion investment. President Trump's budget is much more modest, shifting most of the cost to the states and to the cities. We asked Paul Lewis to join us. He's Vice President for Policy and Finance at the Eno Center for Transportation. And Paul Lewis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
So is our air traffic control system in need of an update?
Yeah, I think the important thing to realize is that the air traffic control system we have works remarkably well. It is the safest in the world, and that's not something that is going to change. What we're seeing, though, is that other countries are implementing newer technologies that allow for a much more efficient system while still maintaining that level of safety. And the current governance of our air traffic control system is inhibiting a move to the U.S. to meet up with our peer nations.
And is that a shift from a sort of a radar-based system to a GPS-based system?
That's right. Yeah, we've been operating on a radar-based system since the 1940s. Other countries are using GPS systems that allow for more direct routing. They allow for easier descents and ascents in and out of airports. And a better awareness of exactly where planes are in the airspace.
But why do we need to privatize or at least create this private nonprofit in order to shift from radar to GPS?
Yeah, so it's something that the FAA has been working on since the 1980s. And the problem is not a lack of competency at the staff level at FAA. There's a lot of very, very smart people there. But to get the funding to implement this multi-billion-dollar project, they have to go to Congress every single year and ask for an appropriation. And the inconsistency and the unregularness of that flow of money inhibits them from making commitments to long-term investments.
So what is a private nonprofit? I get the private part and I get the nonprofit part. When you put them together, what do you have?
Yeah, so it's not pure privatization. And I think it's also important to recognize that this isn't a new idea. The Clinton administration proposed this in the 1990s. The Bush administration had a similar proposal in the 2000s, and now it's resurfaced. The concept is to create a nonprofit, chartered by the federal government that would operate air traffic control at an arm's length from the federal government. The FAA would still, the Federal Aviation Administration, would still exist and would have a very important role in monitoring and ensuring the safety of the entire system. But the new entity would operate at the arm's length and be self-funded through user fees. So instead of relying on taxes and congressional appropriations, it would charge the airlines and other users of the system on its own.
So the people flying, essentially, they would pay the bills?
The correct,
flying, the
yeah.
flying
so,
public?
Right now, how the system works is it's every time you fly, you have a 7.5% ticket tax that you'd see as part of your airfare. That would, under the proposal, go away, and the nonprofit would then start charging weight and distance fees, not on per passengers, but on the aircraft themselves.
Do we know whether that would mean a ticket would be cheaper, more expensive? Do we know?
Yeah, so we did an analysis here at Eno looking at if there's certain flight segments, certain city pairs, certain size of aircraft that might be more affected or less affected, positive or negative, in that kind of regime. And we couldn't find any consistent answer. And so what would likely happen, at least initially, is that the cost of the air travel ticket would go up to so that the airline could cover that new fee, roughly proportional to what the air traffic tax is right now. But if we look at other countries that have done this successfully, they've seen their rates go down over time. And so instead of seeing this a fee that could continue to raise, this would be something that could, in the long run, make it less expensive to fly.
The president said that this would take care of the problems of delays and wait times. Would it solve that problem of air travel?
It's certainly not going to solve every problem. There's a lot of issues that have nothing to do with air traffic control, and sometimes it's limited runways, sometimes it's weather, sometimes it's the fault of airlines if there's a delay. When it comes to delays as a result of the air traffic control system, where it's most relevant is in cities and regions that have high density of traffic and multiple airports. Dallas or Los Angeles, New York, right, have very complex airspace where you have multiple airports, multiple different approaches, and very busy skies. And so those regions tend to have the most delays related to air traffic control, and they stand to benefit the most. But how the U.S. system works on a whole is that a delay in New York also affects how traffic is flying in and out of Cleveland and Memphis and Omaha. So it's a national system with national benefits, and any kind of delay related to air traffic control can have ripple effects throughout the country.
Where do air traffic controllers, they have unions, but where do they stand on this proposal?
Yeah, so there's over 30,000 air traffic controllers in the U.S., and their biggest union supports reform. They decided to support it after the budget sequester, the government shut down from a few years ago, as these events erode the advantage of being part of a federal workforce. And they also looked to their counterparts in other countries and realized that they had exciting, stable jobs that attract young talent to the workforce, and they didn't depend on annual appropriations to get those jobs. Of course, they have stipulations and requirements that go with that, and they want to be sure that the new entity is not a for-profit company, that it has diverse representation on their board of directors and protects the workforce broadly. But in general, they see leaving the federal government actually as a better option for the 30,000 air traffic controllers that makes the system safe today.
It's interesting. And how about the airlines or other people that are part of this infrastructure?
Yeah, there's a pretty broad support. Eno put together a working group a few years ago that included airlines, labor unions from the pilots and the air traffic controllers. We also had business aviation, general aviation, some former government officials, academics. And there was not a complete consensus, but general agreement among the stakeholders that this is a better alternative for the U.S. Mm. There's a lot of apprehension in the general aviation community. This is the folks that fly in private airplanes from small airports. They're concerned that they might see higher fees or they might have restrictions in the airspace and not have as the same amount of ability to fly. But in general, when we look at other countries, this concern has not panned out under similar governance models.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the airlines as well generally support this, not unanimously, but the major airlines are pretty much on board, assuming that they have a seat at the table.
You mentioned the safety record. I just want to underscore that. And we're almost up at a break here, Paul. But just in terms of the flying public, our safety record, how does that stack to other countries?
Yeah, safety record across the board in aviation in developed countries is phenomenal. Air traffic incidents and crashes and certainly fatalities are very rare, regardless of the type of governance, whether it's a government agency or a nonprofit or a government corporation. The bottom line is that the industry has taken safety very, very seriously, and that's paid off.
And that
is a tremendous record.
And that is Paul Lewis. He's Vice President for Policy and Finance at the Eno Center for Transportation. We've been talking about a proposal to create a private nonprofit to operate and manage the country's air traffic control system. I do want to talk with our guests more about larger and different and bigger infrastructure projects as well. And again, you can join our conversation. You can text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I've been talking with Paul Lewis from the Eno Center for Transportation about President Trump's announcement about the creation of a private nonprofit corporation to run air traffic control. This is apparently infrastructure week for the White House, talking about creating public-private partnerships to give states and cities funding to improve their roads, their bridges, and other pieces of their infrastructure. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Paul, we've done a number of programs over the decades, I should say, about our aging infrastructure. And I know the civil engineers, you know, give us oftentimes very low marks or sometimes even failing grades when it comes to our infrastructure. How would you rate that? How would you rate it?
Yeah, I feel like some of the ratings and the rankings of infrastructure that the industry puts out is a little self-serving. And generally, our infrastructure works fairly well. But every time there is a pothole or there's a reason to shut down a bridge for repairs or other kind of investment need, that damages the economy. It's not an issue of safety so much as it is an issue of trying to create a world-class economy and an ability for people and goods to move around throughout the country. And so I think that any time we can try to invest strategically and make smart investments, it's always a good idea.
But do you think we have been lax in terms of just upgrading and improving? I'm thinking of our roads. I think anyone that drives a car will tell you that there are a lot of really lumpy roads. You got potholes that have not been repaired, things like that.
Absolutely. And one of the problems with infrastructure is that it's always exciting to build new things. It's not exciting, particularly politically, to maintain what we have. And we do a pretty poor job of taking good care of the system that we have.
Why? Why?
Well, it's expensive, first of all, to fund maintenance. It's something that we need to continually raise taxes to do. The fuel tax that funds a lot of our infrastructure from the federal and state government is typically not indexed to inflation. And so it requires a political action every time to even keep up with the rate of inflation. And that's something that's a big political lift at the state and the federal government. And then the other thing is that it's also not exciting to make that political lift. Elected officials like to cut ribbons. They don't like to tell you that we're going to raise your taxes so that you can that we hopefully can fix all the potholes.
But what about the highway tax fund? Isn't that supposed to fund these maintenance improvements?
So the highway trust fund at the federal government is funded primarily through fuel taxes on gasoline and diesel. Those taxes haven't been raised since the early 1990s. And the purchasing power of those, due to not only inflation, but also the fact that cars are becoming more fuel efficient, means that we have to maintain and invest in the same amount of road system or a slowly growing road system with fewer revenues. And so the government has tried to bail out that highway trust fund with some general fund revenues, but we haven't seen an overall increase in that fund and the revenues coming in since the 30 years ago.
Is that why we're seeing this public-private partnership idea?
That's part of it. I think that where we see a lot of optimism in the non-profitization of the air traffic control system, we're not as optimistic that the public-private partnerships for highway and public transit investments are going to yield substantial benefits widespread throughout the country. And it's because the dollar figures that they're throwing around are a little misleading. You know, there's a lot of talk of $1 trillion over 10 years.
Right.
But that's not $1 trillion in government grants. That's financing plan of $200 billion over 10 years. And the other $800 billion would come through leveraging private sector investment, which, of course, needs to get repaid primarily through tolls or local taxes. So it would try to leverage or encourage other user fees or local funds to complete that $1 trillion package.
I mean, I could see on a busy highway why that could be profitable for a private company, but, you know, a less trafficked road is not going to give that kind of return to somebody who might want to invest in our infrastructure.
Yeah, and that's the problem. A lot of the potential for public-private partnerships are in dense urban areas where there's a lot of congestion and there's a lot of users on the roads. And also they have a political system where users are generally okay with some kind of toll. In rural areas or in areas that don't have high traffic volumes, the ability to raise revenues to pay back the loans for those public-private partnerships often just isn't there.
But I think it is also a philosophical question about, you know, what is the responsibility of government, of the federal government? And we have, you know, highways that cross the country. And it's part our economy is dependent on having good infrastructure. Obviously, for people living in this country, we need that as well. I mean, I don't know whether you have a philosophical opinion about that, Paul.
Well, there's been since in the Constitution, there's a government role to facilitate interstate commerce. And that's been the impetus for having a national investment program for the highways, for the transit systems that we have, for the freight systems that we have, the waterway systems. That's been around for a long time. The question is what is the right amount of money to put towards that in grants? And can we perhaps leverage some of that through toll roads and other public-private partnerships? And by creating a public-private partnership and having a private sector design, build, operate, maintain a roadway doesn't mean that it's a private roadway. The public still maintains ownership of that road and still has a responsibility to steward that partnership. It's just a different way of getting at the same infrastructure and perhaps injecting some innovation that the government wouldn't be able to do normally. But even that is up to debate, depending on the level of commitment and staffing and training at our public agencies.
What kind of innovation are you talking about?
Well, so what can happen sometimes in roadways that go out for a public-private partnership is that the private entity can come back and say, hey, we like your proposal, but we think we can tweak it. We think we can do these other improvements or different ways of laying down the pavement or different bridge designs that can provide a much better product, perhaps enhanced access or better flow at a reduced cost, not only up front, but over the full 30, 40, 50-year life cycle of that asset. Because the private sector is inherently incentivized to reduce costs over the entire life of the project, they often find ways of thinking about projects in a way that, the public sector doesn't traditionally do.
What's the chance that we would have a foreign government be the funder for private roads? I'm looking at something from The Intercept. The headline is Trump's America First Infrastructure Plan. Let Saudi Arabia and Blackstone take care of it. Do you see that on the horizon, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, we live in a globalized economy, and folks and businesses from around the world want to invest in things that have reasonable rates of returns. And a lot of times, toll roads that are under some kind of public-private partnership have a pretty good rate of return and are an attractive investment. And it could be a pension fund from California that invests in that fund. It could be a foreign investor from Australia or Saudi Arabia or what have you. That doesn't mean that they're controlling the road or they're going to be taking people off the road or affecting commutes in any way, but they're going after attractive investments. And so I don't think that's really a concern for the traveling public per se.
That's Paul Lewis, Vice President for Policy and Finance at the Eno Center for Transportation. We've been talking about plans to upgrade, improve our infrastructure. And again, you can join our conversation. Call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments here. One, a tweet from Laura. She says, weren't Pennsylvania gas taxes just raised 6% to pay for roads? And Paul, I don't know how intimately involved in our gas tax situation here in Pennsylvania is or not, but do you have a comment for Laura?
Yeah, I mean, that's six cents per gallon. There's been a lot of states all over the country that are increasing their fuel taxes in the past few years to pay for roadways. And a lot of that is coming from the fact that for many years they didn't. In the mid-2000s, we were in a boom time. There was a low-tax mentality in this country. And then after the recession, governments were loath to increase fuel taxes because the economy was so fragile. Hmm. Now that we're seeing a robust economy and people are back to work and unemployment is very low, the state governments feel much more comfortable with raising fuel taxes. It's not necessarily creating a bunch of new revenue that will go into roadways, but actually accounting for the fact that we haven't increased it in a decade or more and trying to take advantage of the situation where we've seen erosion of the purchasing power due to better fuel economy and inflation.
And I believe even New Jersey raised its gas tax. People in Pennsylvania are always happy to drive through New Jersey and pay a little bit less for gas. Here's a comment from Rick. I'm wondering why the Pennsylvania Turnpike from one end to the other is now $51 in tolls. I can drive from Washington, D.C. all the way to Florida on I-95, and I don't pay one penny in tolls. Thank you. Do you have an answer to that, Paul?
Yeah, so the tolling system in this country is really interesting. In 1956, when they established the interstate highway system, they said that all new roads built with federal money will not have any new taxes on them unless it's new capacity that's only been done in the past couple decades. The New Jersey Turnpike, the Pennsylvania Turnpike, the Ohio Turnpike, those were all roads that were built prior to 1956, so they're exempt from those taxes. The tolls on those roadways, of course, pay for that infrastructure. They also do a pretty good job of helping to manage demand. If we got rid of the tolls on the New Jersey Turnpike, it would be so flooded with traffic that you wouldn't be able to move. And so not only are we paying for that infrastructure, but we're also making sure that traffic can flow at least somewhat reasonably.
Let me get Mary to join our conversation.
My name is Mary. I'm from Philadelphia. I don't like the idea of anything private managing our airspace. All of the experiences that I've seen and heard of when a private entity takes over something this important, it does not turn out well. I would like to see it stay in the hands of agencies that are directly or indirectly accountable to the public.
Thanks for calling in, Mary. Paul, what do you say in response to that? And I'm sure she's not alone in her opinion.
No, and I think that those are the exact kind of questions we need to be asking. And this proposal, if it moves through Congress, needs to be very closely vetted and make sure that we're going to get the kind of outcome we want. I would encourage her to look at other countries, particularly Canada, Australia, the UK, and Germany, that have done this, where they have taken their air traffic control system and moved it to some kind of nonprofit or other entity that's at an arm's length. Of course, not a profit-making entity. And a nonprofit of this nature would very much be accountable to the federal government and directly overseen by the FAA. When we look at our peer nations that have done this, they've done it in a way that has encouraged smart investments. They've protected the workforce, and they've ensured safety for the traveling public. And when you look closely at those cases, it's a pretty substantial success story.
Let me ask you about public transit, and I'm thinking of Amtrak in particular, the fact that Penn Station is going through some pretty serious upgrading as a result of a couple of derailments, not fatal derailments. I don't believe, although one, there might have been one, a woman who was, if not killed, certainly seriously injured. But what does that tell us about the state of our public transit infrastructure?
Yeah, public transit infrastructure is in a pretty tough state, particularly the rail infrastructure that has been neglected for many, many years, and a lot of due to lack of funding. The bottom line, due to lack of funding, we've taken our rail infrastructure and maintained it just enough to make sure that it's safe enough and we can move trains over it. But we're missing out on a lot, and the delays now that are happening through the Union Station or Penn Station and the tunnels leading in and out of New York, all up and down the New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, the Northeast Corridor, those tracks are in need of repair, and in many cases they're usable, but they could be much more efficient. They could be much faster. And more effective if we had more money to strategically invest in the kind of infrastructure and bring it up to date, frankly.
Almost out of time here, but is that public money, private money, or are we back to public-private partnerships?
Yeah, for this, it's probably going to be public money. We're not in a place where public transit makes a profit. And so we could certainly leverage and use private contractors to help bring that up to a state of good repair, to bring in some innovations and perhaps some efficiencies. But really, it's going to be a public sector effort, and we're going to need to find public sector revenues to make that happen.
Well, Paul Lewis, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. Vice President for Policy and Finance at the Eno Center for Transportation. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And we put something on Twitter today, a kind of a preview of today's show. Diana Martinez is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.